All right, thank you,
Thank
Tony.
you.
Maybe I should stop talking. Well, I want to thank the KITP for hosting my visit. I've been here in many capacities, but this is the first time I've been here on a sabbatical, and it's actually really wonderful to come here unassociated with a program. So now our program on boundary layers, planetary boundary layers, is starting, so I have to start working, but it was very nice for the past several months. So I'd like to tell you about some work that I've done recently with my two French collaborators, Antoine Vanai and Pierre Delplace, both at ENS Lyon, we found a rather surprising connection between an area of physics that's very hot right now, which has to do with topology, especially in quantum situations, and a seemingly old subject of geophysical fluid dynamics. And as I hope you'll see later in the talk, actually we can make the case that geophysicists discovered topological insulators before anyone else. And so this connection was just waiting to be discovered. So the outline of the talk is as follows. I'm going to begin rather gently with some observations about the El Niño and Kelvin waves. Kelvin waves are going to play a central role in what follows. They're going to be the main player. And then I'm going to abruptly switch to something seemingly totally different, the quantum Hall effect and topological insulators. And that will lead me to a discussion of broken discrete symmetries, in this case, time reversal symmetry. And then we're going to look at some simulations and some observations of some fluids that behave rather similarly to things that have been seen in the quantum Hall effect and topological insulators. I'll talk about some other topological waves, classical topological waves. And then I'm going to get into the mathematical meat of the subject, which is the shallow water equation. So probably many of you haven't seen the shallow water equation, so I will sketch their derivation starting from the Navier-Stokes equation here that I've put up on the board. Then we'll talk about the Chern number. The Chern number quantifies the non-trivial topology of a system, and see some of the consequences of this, namely the protection of from scattering by obstacles and also nonlinear effects. There's a bunch of new systems under investigation, some by people here in this room, that are very interesting and have similar properties to what I'll describe. So this is a plot of the sea surface height measured by a NASA satellite by altimetry, and it is a measure of the temperature of the ocean, or what's really plotted here is some deviation from some mean temperature. The sea surface range of heights being shown here are from minus 22 centimeters to 22 centimeters, so very small changes in the height. But the height is related to the temperature because, of course, water expands when it's warmer. And so this represents a warmer, anomalously warm part of the Pacific and an anomalously cool part. So if I let this movie go, we'll see a wave propagating from the eastern, from the western Pacific to the eastern Pacific, right here, this pulse, and there's another one, this pulse of warm water. That's the Kelvin wave, and it's an equatorial Kelvin wave. It lies right on the equator. Time scale is months for that. And this was a weak El Niño year. This pool of warm water accumulating off the coast of South America has a number of effects. It's actually, this El Niño is the largest climate oscillation that affects us on sort of human time scales. And so one of the effects is that when there's warm water pooling over here, there's less upwelling of cold water. And that means that nutrients are cut off from reaching the shallow waters where the fish live. So fishermen have generally decreased catches. And that's why this phenomenon was called the El Niño. It was often observed by fishermen to occur around Christmas time, El Niño being the Christ child. So this was a weak El Nino, but we can still see that the Kelvin waves were responsible for pushing this warm water across the Pacific. That's one component of the El Nino system. Now, the El Nino is not just a phenomenon in the oceans, but it's also in the atmosphere. It's really a coupled ocean-atmosphere phenomena. And during neutral conditions, most of the warm water is located on this side of the Pacific, over in the Western Pacific, and that induces convection over there, cloud formation. But during an El Nino, this warm pool, as I mentioned, moves over towards South America, and convection can occur there. We get more clouds over on that side. And then that has effects on the weather throughout the world. Now, actually, this represents kind of a circling back for me. When I was a graduate student at Princeton in my last year, I started doing some work on climate and noticed that there was a connection between the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the temperature. The temperature of the Earth fluctuates from year to year, just naturally, and carbon dioxide also fluctuates about this overall growing trend. And at the time, we had some speculations about what was going on. We could see that the correlation between temperature and carbon dioxide increase was strongest in the equatorial regions. And these fluctuations are occurring over a very short time scale, so they're not related to global warming. They're rather the response of the carbon in various reservoirs in the Earth to natural fluctuations in the temperature. So we knew that the correlations were strongest in the equator, and a lot of work has occurred since then. And various regions have been identified as sources for additional carbon to the atmosphere during an El Nino. So for example, during El Ninos, we tend to have droughts in the Amazon, and that causes decreased photosynthesis, so decreased absorption of carbon dioxide. Then there can be hotter temperatures than normal in Africa, leading to more decomposition, more fires in Indonesia, leading to a release of carbon dioxide. All three of these things contribute to the positive correlation between temperature and the amount of carbon dioxide that goes into the atmosphere.
Right, can you just remind us what humans put in?
We're putting in on the order of 5 gigatons of carbon, I think, per eight gigatons per carbon per year, and about 5 stays in the atmosphere.
Kelvin wave happens when there's El Nino, or?
A Kelvin wave is responsible for the transport of warm water across the Pacific when there's an El Nino.
Okay.
So it's the transport mechanism for this warm water that's part of the El Nino, but the whole oscillation involves the atmosphere and the ocean working together.
Kelvin wave, that's not happening every year.
That's right. So it's a nonlinear dynamical system. Some people model it with a low dimensional chaotic system. And so there's a lot of work about modeling and understanding the El Nino, which I'm not going to go into. We're just looking at one component of this system. Now, another manifestation of these changes in the tropics is that they have an influence on atmospheric rivers. So depending on where the warm area is, we have more moisture in the atmosphere. And this is a particularly long atmospheric river from October of this past year, stretching all the way from Indonesia to the Pacific Northwest. And if you look carefully, you might notice there's some smoke here. That's the fires from the Sonoma fires. So unfortunately, this atmospheric river, as often is the case, is transporting water to the Pacific Northwest and not reaching California. However, this weekend, a atmospheric river is predicted to come to the Pacific Northwest and then work its way southward towards California. And it has record amounts of moisture in it. This is the vertically integrated amount of moisture. So the amounts here are on the order of 5 centimeters, which is very high for the atmosphere. However, at the present time, it's thought that when this arrives in Southern California on Saturday, there won't be very much uplift. So hopefully the rainfall rates won't be enough to trigger the mudslides again in Montecito. But we know that these forecasts are rather unreliable. The last atmospheric river that occurred a couple weeks ago was predicted to lead to flooding in Santa Barbara, but it actually hit further north, the strongest part. So the whole point of this is to say that understanding mechanisms, particular mechanisms of the climate system, can shed light on the larger picture of climate and weather. Okay, so now, after that, I want to switch to a seemingly completely different topic, which was recognized in a recent Nobel Prize. In particular, I want to focus on the work of David Thallus. Thallus, part of his prize, recognized his contribution to understanding the integer quantum Hall effect, the reason why the plateaus in the resistance in the quantum Hall effect are so precisely quantized in terms of fundamental constants, Planck's constant, and the electric charge. And so he realized that topology was the answer to this. The topology gives us some robustness and can explain this quantization. And I will sort of sketch the thinking a little bit, but I'll mainly illustrate this kind of topological argument with the Kelvin wave, because the mathematics is very similar. We know that quantum mechanics is essentially wave mechanics with an additional interpretation of probability amplitudes as the probability to find a particle, but the wave part is very similar to what I'll be talking about. So in the case of the quantum Hall effect, we have a strong magnetic field that is affecting the motion of electrons that are confined to an essentially two-dimensional layer in some semiconductor. And the effect of this magnetic field is to cause the electrons to circle in tight cyclotron orbits, at least viewed classically. And around the edges of the sample, then, because the orbit can't complete, we can imagine it hopping, sort of skipping along, but always in one direction. And this unidirectionality of the electrons gives us a mechanistic way of understanding the robustness of the current against scattering from impurities. Because if there's some dirt, some impurity that wants to scatter the electron going the other way, well, it's not allowed to do that because of this magnetic field. And the magnetic field behaves very similarly, as we'll see, to the Coriolis force in acting on fluids on large scales, such as the planetary scale. So here, for instance, is a picture of an old Hall bar. And you can see that, you know, the connections to the electrodes for measuring the conductivity, there's a lot of solder here or something. It's not a clean system, and yet it shows this very precise quantization of the conductivity. In fact, it functions now as a standard for resistivity. And here again is the electron hopping along the edge there. So the idea is that if we have a wave coming in and it hits some impurity, in the absence of any magnetic field, it could scatter in all directions. But in the case of these edge, unidirectional edge currents, they just keep on going. So Laughlin and then Halperin offered some intuitive arguments for why there was this quantization. And they imagined, for instance, having a disk of semiconductor and slowly adding a magnetic field through the center, a quantum of magnetic flux, and then calculating the electric field due to that slowly increasing magnetic field. That electric field would be radially outward, so that would cause the transport of charge from one side to the other, and that could be related to the conductivity. So these arguments are probably essentially correct, but it was really Thallus who put the arguments into their final form in connecting them most clearly to topology. Now, recently, or about at least over the past 10 years, another system that's related has been discovered, and they're called topological insulators, where now the material itself doesn't have to be put in a magnetic field. But due to the fact that there's a strong spin-orbit interaction, because the material involves heavy nuclei like mercury, there is a coupling between the spin of the electrons and their direction of motion. And the result is that in this quantum spin Hall system, or topological insulator, spin species of one spin of electrons, say up, go to the left, and down go to the right. And so an experiment can be done with mercury telluride, looking at larger thicknesses of this topological insulator, and find that if we look at one spin species, it propagates in one direction. So this is the dispersion, the energy versus wave number. So if we think about that in terms of a velocity, the slope of this plot is basically the velocity of our electron. So the red, the spin up particle, goes to the right, and the blue goes to the left. I guess it's the opposite here. And so this spectrum shows us a gap between this band, this upper band, and the lower band, and these edge modes that interpolate between the two bands. And the advantage, or the neat thing about these topological insulators, is that using angle-resolved photoemission spectroscopy, this dispersion relation can be seen directly. We see this linear dispersing band of spin-up electrons and spin-down electrons. So I want you to remember that dispersion, because we're going to see something very similar in just a moment. So first I want to make an excursion to talk about broken discrete symmetries. And there is a famous theorem in physics, the CPT theorem. CPT means charge, conjugation, parity, and time reversal. And the product of these three operations should leave the system unchanged. So this is the identity. So if we're thinking about fluids, neutral fluids, let's not consider charge. Charge isn't doing anything. Let's look at parity and time reversal in the case of a spinning planet. So here's a spinning planet rotating about its axis, and using the right-hand rule, we have the angular rate of rotation pointing up. If we put that in a mirror, then it will appear to rotate in the opposite direction, but then if we apply time reversal symmetry, that will reverse flip this back, so the product of P and T will leave the system invariant. And we can see that more directly if we look at the formula for the Coriolis force. So this represents the acceleration in a rotating frame, and it's due to the force divided by the mass, as it would be in the inertial frame, plus these corrections. And this one, which is the most important in the geophysical context, is the Coriolis force, 2 times the angular rate of rotation crossed into the velocity. And we see that if under time reversal symmetry, if we hold omega fixed, and then v will change direction, because t, the time derivative, will change sign, then the acceleration will change. So this is odd under time reversal symmetry. The important thing in most geophysical fluids is the vertical component of omega. That is, at a local patch of our planet, we look at upwards from Santa Barbara, and we look at the component of omega in that direction, because most of the fluid motion is in the horizontal direction, and therefore it's the vertical component. And that quantity is called F, after the Foucault pendulum, because this is the same term that appears in the freshman physics calculation for the Foucault pendulum, and it changes sign between the two hemispheres. So the two hemispheres of our planet break time reversal symmetry in an opposite sense. And the equator represents a boundary between these two regions. So those of you who know something about topological insulators will already see that this situation is ripe for finding non-trivial edge modes. So now let's look at what is known about equatorial waves. All right, there's our sphere. So the dispersion of waves in a shallow system of shallow water equations, which I'll write down for you in a moment, they're basically equations that allow for surface waves on the surface of water, or maybe internal waves if the fluid is stratified. In the presence of this Coriolis force, the spectrum looks like this. So here's wave number and frequency. Now, recently at Brown, we had a search for a hard condensed matter experimentalist. And I was on the search committee. And Baylor Fox Kemper had lent me an old book on geophysical fluid dynamics. And as these candidates came through my office, I flipped to show them, without saying anything, a plot that looks very much like this. And without exception, each of them, immediately their eyes lit up and they recognized that this was the dispersion of a topological insulator. And they wonder, what the hell is it doing in this book? So what's going on here? If we didn't have any rotation, we would have waves propagating out at some constant speed, in fact, at the speed of this Kelvin wave. But as soon as there's rotation, then what happens is that waves that are excited, say, near the equator, are deflected back towards the equator. And waves that are away from the equator, where the Coriolis force is strong, become gapped. It requires some non-zero frequency before they can propagate. All right? And the Coriolis force grows linearly away from the equator. So if one works out the eigenfunctions of the eigenvalue problem of the linearized waves, one gets Hermite polynomials. In fact, it looks rather like a hydrogen atom. And you can see that the spectrum breaks up into these different components. There are also some waves called planetary waves or Rossby waves that can be excited. And so these are long frequency waves, and they are also due to the Coriolis force, but they're not due so much to the stratification due to the gravity part of the problem. So those are present even in the absence of a change in density. And we're going to see these pieces again in a moment. So when our paper was being reviewed, we got this comment from one of the referees. The question of why the equator supports a unidirectional wave, the Kelvin wave, is interesting scientifically, important mathematically. I have asked the question myself and been unsatisfied with my own answer, as well as the answer of atmospheric and ocean scientists. So there seems to have been some realization that although the spectrum could be calculated, there was something mysterious about it. Why were these two waves, why did they pop out of the spectrum? There was some realization that something deeper was going on, but it wasn't clear what that was. So now I want to show you some simulations. And as I said, we're going to get a little bit more abstract as the talk goes on. But before I do that, I want to sort of show you how these things look. So I'm going to be looking at a model of two fluids on a rotating planet. There's a denser lower fluid and a lighter upper fluid, and they have different temperatures. So the upper one's going to have a lower temperature than the lower one. It's going to be stably stratified. The higher the temperature, the lower the density of the fluid. And we'll look at excitations of this fluid. So the first experiment I'm going to do, being shown here, is for a non-rotating planet. So the only effect here, the only restoring force, is that due to buoyancy. If we have a bulge like this and we push it upward, then gravity wants to push it down, and we get this propagation of waves outward like a rock in a pond going around the sphere, and then because it's on a sphere, it comes back. And if we look at that over here on a cylindrical projection, we see the wave goes out to the antipode of the sphere and then comes back, and so on. It'll just keep on going on and on. So now the only difference I'm going to use the same initial condition, but I'm going to turn on rotation. So now there's two restoring forces, the Coriolis force and the force of buoyancy. That's the Kelvin wave. Notice how it's non-dispersive. That packet will just go around and around. And it's confined to the equator because, as I mentioned before, any fluid that deflects away from the equator tends to be brought back by the Coriolis force. Now, there's two such waves. This wave is symmetric with respect to the equator. There's a wave that's anti-symmetric with respect to the equator. That's called the Yannai wave. And we'll see that it actually has a different group and phase velocity, which is why you can see it kind of phasing as it goes along. It's still confined to the equator, right? So its dispersion relation was not just linear. So if you want to play with these waves, I have an app in the App Store you can download for free called GCM. It's just for Macs, not for iPhones. I need to get a student to convert it for iPhones. iPhones could now run this thing, I'm pretty sure. And you can play with all sorts of different things with this.
Sorry, actually, so yep. in the previous slide showed how the wave propagate.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it looks like they are counter-propagating, or is that just some...
You mean that there was some other stuff going on?
No, I mean, just the estimate of the chain insulator should actually be chiral, right? I mean, this actually looks like a, non-chiral mode.
This is not, well, it's only going one direction. It's going around and around the equator of this planet. And this one also is propagating. Its group velocity is always going from the west to the east. Yeah. Now, we can observe the climate system. And this is a plot of frequency versus wave number, dispersion, of clouds in the equatorial Pacific. And as I argued earlier, clouds are connected to the Kelvin waves, to the pooling of warm water. And if we look at the symmetric part of the spectrum, then the Kelvin wave emerges, and also the Rossby or planetary waves. And if we look at the anti-symmetric part of the spectrum, the part anti-symmetric with respect to the equator, then the Yannai waves appear. So there's actually has been direct observational evidence for these kinds of waves, these that I will now show have a topological origin. There's been this observation at least since the mid-2000s, if not earlier. All right, so now, as I mentioned, the quantum mechanics is not the essential thing in these topological waves or topological modes, but rather the wave-like nature. And now, by now, many artificial systems have been constructed that support these kinds of topological waves. So this is a system of spinning gyroscopes that are coupled together by springs. And because the gyroscopes are all spinning in the same direction, they all want to precess in the same direction in gravity, and so they break time reversal symmetry because of that spinning. So it's not the Coriolis force, but it's similar in the sense that it breaks time reversal symmetry. Then there's fluid systems looking at the propagation of sound, artificial lattices that carry light, and so on. There's a whole set of these systems. I want to just focus on this one, though, because there's some nice views. Experimentally, the system has been constructed, and what we're going to see now is a view of a edge mode propagating around the system. Color is going to be indicating which gyroscopes have the maximum amplitude. So some excitation has been generated here, and you can see that it's just going to propagate around the edges of this system and not penetrate into the interior. So it's very similar to the edge modes that we were discussing before. And we'll see some more experiments of this type.
How big are these
things? I'm not sure. I think they're not very big. There's so this is just human scale. Yeah.
Yeah.
The hexagon
So these are arranged in this, this hexagonal lattice to give a gap in the wave spectrum. So. So we need a non-trivial, all these artificial systems are based on lattices that have some non-trivial spectrum that can then be gapped. And that allows a clear observation of this topological mode that is, interpolates in between the gaps.
Yeah, in the original chain insulator model, like Hodan's model, actually there's an imaginary hopping.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I cannot imagine how to get that in this kind of classical system, actually.
Right, I'll show you how to do that with our wave system in just a moment. In fact, we mapped it to a Haldane lattice. Okay, so now I want to present the shallow water equations because these are the simplest equations that we found that support these topological waves. So these are the equations of motion here. H is the height of our wave. So imagine, say, this is water down here and air up here. Or a vacuum, and u is a two-component velocity vector, velocity in the x or y directions. So I'd like to derive this, or at least sketch the derivation of this set of equations. So I'm going to start from the Navier-Stokes equation, which is written on both sides of the board. The first equation represents the conservation of momentum, and it says that the density of the fluid times this advective derivative, that's the derivative that's moving with a parcel of fluid, responds to the forces on the fluid. So there's a pressure force, and then there's some other forces that we're going to add in just a moment. And then the second equation represents the conservation of mass. So the fluid density can be moved around, and the total mass needs to be conserved. So the first simplification we're going to make is we're just going to say that rho is a constant. So we'll deal with just an incompressible fluid. So if that's the case, then the second equation just reduces to del dot V equals zero. And notice, by the way, that this is really three equations, the three components of the velocity. Then we have a fourth equation here. But we also have a fourth unknown, the pressure. So this represents a closed set of equations. Okay, so now what I want to do is to do some averaging to reduce the this system to the shallow water equations. So what does shallow water mean? It means that the wavelength here of our wave, we'll call it lambda, say, is much larger than the height of our fluid. So omega lambda is much larger than the height. And therefore, if I integrate from 0 to the height dz of, for instance, this equation, del dot v equals 0, then if I look at the z derivative of vz, of course, integrating that will just give me the velocity at the top and bottom points. At the bottom, it's 0 because I have a flat bottom. So at the top, the velocity is just dh dt. So that gives us dh dt. And then I have the divergence of the two components of the velocity in the x and y directions, which I'm going to vertically average. So I'll call those u. And then we have this equation equals 0, where u is just going to be 1 over h times the integral from 0 to z of the either the x component or the y component of the velocity dz. Pardon?
0 to h.
0 to h, yes, thank you. 0 to h. The z component will neglect because our fluctuations are going to be long wavelength, and so most of the motion will be in the horizontal. So that's the first of these equations up there. And then the second equation would be will come from vertically averaging the top part of the equation, the momentum equation. So I won't go through that. I'll let you do that as an exercise. But I do want to add now these two terms. This is the Coriolis force, which, as I said, acts on these the horizontal components of velocity, and also the force of gravity. So if we have a bulge here, then this divergence of this gradient of the gravity wants to smooth that out. So we now have both the buoyancy and the Coriolis force. Yep?
Does the Coriolis force involve the vorticity, the circulation vector of time?
Yep.
Does that mean that if you use n as your vector, doesn't that mean f depends on r?
Yes. That's right, exactly. Right, so F is going to be zero at the equator, and it's going to grow towards the poles, right? And that's going to be very important in what follows. Now we can non-dimensionalize this. So there's a speed, which is the square root of g times the average height of our fluid. And there's a length scale called the deformation length, which is basically gotten by taking the speed of the waves divided by the rotation rate of the planet. And we could scale out everything, make everything dimensionless, express time in units of the rotation rate and speed in units of c and so on. And we get this simple set of equations if we linearize. So I'll assume that I can replace little h by big H. We'll just look at gentle ripples here. And over here, I'll drop this term. So that term is quadratic in U, and if U is small, then I can drop it. Then I just have a linear set of equations that I can express as a kind of Schrodinger equation. And in fact, for this system, this operator H is Hermitian. So it has a very close similarity to a quantum mechanical system. We know what to do. We can diagonalize it, get the wave dispersion. So that was what was done in the 60s, allowing for F to vary in the y direction. So that's not too hard to do, but it requires solving a partial differential equation. But with the magic of our current understanding of topological insulators.
Sorry,
yep.
So, you know, these are separable. I mean, you're doing the geophysical sort of traditional approximation, in which case the equations are separable.
Yes.
So you basically have a separable equation for the angular coordinates.
Right.
Right. So.
But in the y direction, in the north-south direction,
Understood. There's
something non-trivial. That's our non-trivial part of the problem to solve.
I'm just saying that, I mean, so far, you're staying in the traditional limit, which is you're only assuming the Coriolis term, you drop the omega squared term, which is fine.
Yep.
Right, but in that limit, you know, going back to the Laplace's tidal equation, these are a separable equation, and you can find the spherical eigenfunction.
Yep.
Those are the Huff functions.
Yep. You can work on the sphere if you want.
Okay.
Yes.
So far you're saying confined in the equatorial region, so you've lost the plane, not the beta plane, for those who know the language.
Yes.
Okay.
But you're jumping ahead of me. I'm almost there. Okay. Yeah. So all right. Well, first of all, before we go there, let's put this on a lattice. So notice that there are these three degrees of freedom, the displacement in the vertical direction and the x and y components of the velocity. So that's like a three-band model in the language of band theory, quantum mechanics. And we can map this to a lattice system. It's basically the Haldane lattice that you were talking about, which has some hopping between different sites. So here, the height field is at the centers of these tetrahedra, and then, or these parallelograms, I guess, and then the U and V components of the velocity are at these points. So our unit cell is a three-site unit cell, which means that we can get a non-trivial spectrum that has a gap. And it's that gap that allows us to see the topological mode, because that's the thing that will be crossing between the gapped region. So we've done this just to exercise our understanding, and we put it on a doubly periodic plane, a torus. And because it's doubly periodic, this is a kind of planet with two equators, because the Coriolis parameter, if it's positive in this region and negative in these regions, we glue the edges around, then we have two equators. If we look at the eigenspectrum, then we have a doubling of the waves that we saw in our planetary problem. So there's a Kelvin wave, this red one, that's propagating to the right, and another Kelvin wave that's propagating to the left, and they are, the color, these eigenfunctions are colored by where they're localized, where their support is. So their support, the red supported functions are around this bottom equator, and the blue ones are around the top equator. So we have a good intuitive understanding now of how these waves are going to arise in our system. We have two boundaries instead of one that we have in an ordinary planet. Okay, so now we'll get to the final story about the topology. So as Lars was indicating, we're thinking about being away from the equator, and we're just going to focus on a little locally flat region where F, the Coriolis parameter, is constant. And the beauty of this, what we now call the bulk edge correspondence, is that we're allowed to study the wave functions away from the boundary and study their topological nature. And by looking at their topology, we learn something about their behavior at the equator, at the boundary between these two dissimilar topological insulators, because they break time reversal symmetry in an opposite way. So here's our Earth. And we're going to imagine being in Santa Barbara, locally flat, and we'll just look at the waves in this region. When F is constant, our system of equations can be diagonalized by just diagonalizing a 3x3 matrix. That's the most difficult step that we have to do. But then we're going to imagine changing the latitude of this point. And so that's indicated over here in parameter space. F is our Coriolis parameter. And so at this latitude, it takes perhaps this value. If we were at the North Pole, it would be up here. If we were at the South Pole, it would be down here. And kx and ky refer to the wave number in the x and y directions. Because this is flat and is f is constant, then we can diagonalize it, and we have just simply plane waves in x and y directions. So let's look at what those plane waves look like. So our dispersion of waves has this form, and you can see that there's a gap that's of order f. So if f, the Coriolis parameter, were 0, that just gives us omega equals plus or minus ck, which is just the linear dispersing waves. But now there's a gap. And there's a kind of particle hole symmetry in this spectrum. There's negative frequency solutions and positive frequency solutions that are related by changing the sign of k. That's a reflection of the fact that the fields are real valued, the displacements are real valued. So unlike in quantum mechanics, where we would be dealing with intrinsically complex wave functions. Yes. Over here, to give some intuitive feeling for why these edge modes arise, I've plotted something called the Berry curvature. So I'll define that in a moment. But you can think of it just as a measure of the degree of non-trivial topology. And it's positive down for these negative frequency solutions in the southern hemisphere and negative in the positive frequency solutions in the southern hemisphere. But it flips in the other hemisphere, because the two hemispheres are related by time reversal symmetry. So by continuity, the negative frequency solutions need to match on to these positive frequency solutions with the same Berry curvature as they pass through the equator. And that's the reason why there are these modes that exist, the Kelvin and Yannai waves, in this region. They're from continuity of the Berry curvature, which is a kind of tag for this band. This negative frequency solution, positive frequency solution must match at the equator, and that's where the frequency will be 0. All right, so let's... I think Poincaré discovered these waves, a long time ago, yeah. All right, so let's diagonalize this 3x3 matrix. So here's our frequency eigenvalue, and we've gone to plane waves, diagonalize that matrix, and here's one of our positive frequency solutions. And I want to show you now the singularity in this solution. So you might actually already see it. As k goes to 0, there's something that is singular about the phase of this solution. And we could see that particularly clearly if in parameter space, we map parameter space to a sphere. We say kx, ky, and f are related by the polar angles on the sphere. And we're looking at a surface of a constant radius because it turns out that the radius doesn't matter in this wave function. So if we do that, then this is the form for the wave function. It has a very simple form. And if we look at, say, cosine theta equals 1 or minus 1 at the top or bottom where f is maximum, then we have this singularity, cosine phi minus I sine phi. And so that's like e to the I phi. And that means that at the pole, the phase is ill-defined. We have a kind of coordinate singularity. We can, because wave functions are only defined up to a phase, we can push that phase singularity around, but we can't get rid of it. It's really the same theorem as the theorem that you can't comb the hairs on a sphere. If you have a sphere covered with hairs, there's always going to be a cowlick somewhere, and you can push that cowlick around, but you can't get rid of it. From the high energy perspective, it's the old Dirac monopole. So we have a solenoid coming in, and it's releasing its magnetic field going in any direction. So we have a nice source of magnetic flux from this magnetic monopole. And we can flip that, we can move that, that Dirac string wherever we want, but there's always going to be a place where the Ehrenhof-Bohm phase factor is going to vary rapidly as we go around this infinitesimal string. So there's a little bit of mathematics involved with this, but the key point is that if this part of the this component, the U component, the X component of the velocity has a phase factor of e to the I phi, and the Y component has e to the minus I phi, there's a net factor of e to the 2 I phi, and that's quantified by something called the Chern number. When we integrate this quantity, it gives us the number 2. The number 2 tells us that there are going to be two topological modes. Those two topological modes are the Kelvin wave and the Yannai wave. It all fits together really quite beautifully. And when we saw this, it really just dropped into our lap. We were kind of amazed. Okay, so now I want to tell you some consequences of this. So let's go back to the spectrum of our waves, and we're going to do some numerical experiments. I'm going to generate a wave at this low frequency and scatter it off of a region where I've artificially changed the density of the fluid so that the waves are moving more slowly. And then I'm going to scatter another wave at higher frequency off of this region. Down here, when I start with a Kelvin wave, it can be scattered and turn into a planetary wave, and we're going to see that. But up here, it can't be converted into anything. The Yannai wave is going to have an opposite symmetry with respect to the equator. So we're going to have a protection against this scattering. So here's our low frequency wave up here. I'm going to generate this wave, and it's a Kelvin wave. It's going to propagate, and here's this region where the water has become shallower. You can think of it as shoals in on an ocean, and the waves are going to come and hit this thing, and let me speed it up a bit. You can see it's a long wavelength wave, and it's going to reflect back, and this kind of double lobe pattern that you're seeing as the wave comes back, that's the Rossby wave. It's been converted to a Rossby wave. So now let's do the same experiment, but with a much shorter wavelength and much higher frequency wave. So there's our pulse that I've produced. And since I'm making a wave packet, there's still some contamination from some other frequencies, but it's mainly this one packet here. And we'll send it into that same region. And although it gets dilated, it just keeps on going. And we can watch it go around and around. So there's a kind of topological robustness here, and perhaps that's important in the climate system. As the Kelvin wave propagates across the ocean, for instance, it's protected to some extent by this kind of topological behavior. So this can be illustrated in this experiment. So first of all, this is a high frequency wave which is above the gap, and so you can see that this wave is not topologically protected. It goes into the interior, it gets spread out. The second wave is a low frequency topological wave, and some defects have been introduced. Some gyroscopes have been removed here. And you can see it just works its way around unhindered and will keep on going around. So it's able to be protected against that scattering. Now, something different from quantum mechanics that we can do with our waves is we can now go and look at their nonlinear behavior. Let's look at what happens as we up the amplitude of the waves, and we no longer make the linearized approximation, but we use our numerical simulation to see what the waves do. It's a little bit like in quantum mechanics to look at the many-body effects, but it's not really the same thing. Nevertheless, we might expect something interesting to happen. In the fractional quantum Hall effect, the electron-electron interaction becomes important, and a whole bunch of new plateaus arise, and we have fractional charge, fractionalization of the particles. Very, very strange. Something similar like that happened in our wave system. Well, I don't think anything quite that exotic happens, but here's a low amplitude wave, and it's now going to be impinging on a region where I've sped up the wave instead of slowed it down. And you can see what happened. No, sorry, this is still slowing it down. What happens is that it just gets bunched up and then kind of explodes through. So this low frequency wave survives okay. And if we blow up that region, you can see actually now the grid scale of my simulation that the wave got compressed down nearly down to the lattice scale. So this next wave down below is of intermediate amplitude. And as it impinges on this region, the amplitude grows even larger because it's been slowed down, and we can see that it starts to get distorted in a nonlinear way now and moves through. And finally, the last wave is so strong that it, even without going into this region that slows it down, it begins to break on its own accord. You can see that's already distorting there. So one of the things I'd like to understand is, because these waves are essentially one-dimensional, can we apply some of the lessons from soliton physics, nonlinear physics? Maybe we can actually do something to describe these highly nonlinear situations in an analytical way. I don't know. These are non-dissipative in the sense I've turned off dissipation. In reality, of course, in, say, the ocean Kelvin wave, there is radiation, so it will cool. But yeah, so in, just to simplify things, we turned off dissipation. Okay, so I want to mention some other topologically protected fluid waves besides the ones that I've already mentioned. So these edge waves, I've discussed their existence at the equator between these two topologically dissimilar regions, the north and south hemisphere, but they also exist on the edges of ocean boundaries. That's like the boundary between a topologically non-trivial insulator and vacuum in the language of quantum mechanics. And these have been known for a long time. They're a prediction of our theory. They also exist in the stratosphere of the Earth, where they can go around and around without hitting any barriers. And they're an important part of something called the quasi-biennial oscillation that occurs in the stratosphere. They have recently been argued to occur in some active matter systems. And I will say a word more about those in just a moment. And also electron gas in condensed matter, they've recently been observed, or at least there's an assertion that they've been observed. They may occur in plasmas, tokamaks. I'm collaborating with a scientist at Livermore who's very interested in the possibility that they could be important for fusion. And there's a possibility of trying to understand these flows in situations where there's a very non-trivial mean flow. So the fluid itself has some large circulation, then we can look at the waves about that circulation. If we do that, then there's a well-known approximation called the quasi-linear approximation, where we only consider the scattering of waves off the mean flow, or two waves could generate the mean flow, but we drop a general interaction where two waves go into a third wave. And we might expect that this approximation becomes particularly good for these topological waves because of the protection of the waves against scattering. So Mark Bowick and Christina Marchetti here with their student Shankar have recently done something very interesting. They've looked at active matter and found that on non-trivial surfaces, such as a sphere or a hyperboloid of rotation, that topological waves are also generated that interpolate between the gap between negative and positive frequencies. And this is a particularly interesting example to me because the flow is generated spontaneously. So the sphere isn't rotating as it was in my system. There's no Coriolis force imposed on it, but rather the system spontaneously breaks time reversal symmetry and then exhibits these topological modes. So that may also occur in the fluid system, and I think that'd be interesting to investigate. There's been some very recent work looking at a magnetic analog of what I was just describing, where the sign of the magnetic field changes moving across a sample, and therefore we would expect, just as with the Coriolis force vanishing, there would be edge modes, and there seems to be some experimental evidence for the existence of these unidirectional modes in this system. So I'm going to close with a little philosophical thought. So since I started coming here when this was not even the KITP, but just the ITP, and Jim Langer was the director and was over on the other side of campus, in the 1980s, what if the ITP had hosted a geophysical fluid dynamics program, and Duncan Haldane or David Thallus had attended and seen that there were these funny waves that existed that made the geophysicists perplexed. So it's often said that the band theorists could have discovered topological insulators in the 1970s, in the heyday of band theory. It's probably true, but they lacked the question, really, lacked the tools to think about this. But there was somebody that was kind of thinking about this back around in the 1980s. So does anyone know what this is? This is Feynman's last blackboard, and he says, what I cannot create, I do not understand. Know how to solve every problem that has been solved. He's a modest man. And he says, to learn, Beta Ansatz problem and Kondo effect, but he's scratched it off, so I guess he's learned that. The two-dimensional Hall effect, so I guess it's the integer quantum Hall effect that's interesting to him. This one, I'm not sure. I think it's acceleration temperature, so maybe it's Unruh radiation. Do you think that's what he's... And then nonlinear classical hydrodynamics. So this one and this one, we now see that, well, maybe not the nonlinear part, but we see that there's some connection between the two. And so maybe, you know, at my university, administrators love to push interdisciplinary studies, which usually just means that they want us to do more with less and less. So I have somewhat skeptical view of these when these top-down commands come. But maybe in this case, actually, they were right. So thank you very much. So the wave, well, the simulations I showed you, for instance, that I was also showing you temperature there. So the temperature is one of the things that is moving in this wave packet across the planet in the simulation, but also in the observation. So that is one signal of the Kelvin wave. There's also some velocity components, but the temperature was particularly easy to visualize because it was related to the sea surface height.
So was there any change due to thermal expansion, or is that due to
yes.
It's not actually transport?
Right, yes. That's right. Yep.
David Gross?
So, two questions. One, you gave a beautiful derivation of the topology for the linearized shallow wave equation.
Thanks.
How much of this goes over to the nonlinear?
That's a very good question. Yeah, I'd like to think about that.
But you don't know what
I don't know. I mean, so obviously the linear system is very nice. And as soon as we go to the nonlinear system, maybe mathematicians could teach me how to do that, but I don't know how to do that. Yeah.
But do you, from the numerical evidence, do you think these are topologically protected?
It seems so, as long as the amplitude is not too large. But we saw that as I cranked up the amplitude,
saw some distortion, but you didn't see.
That's right. It still kept on going. So maybe there's some sense in which it's still protected.
Second question is, in the real, in our world, you talked about the Yannai waves, Kelvin waves. You only talked about Kelvin waves.
Yeah.
What are the Yannai waves?
So the Yannai waves are there too, but at least for the El Nino, the wave tends to be symmetric, approximately symmetric about the equator. But it's only approximate because, of course, the Earth doesn't have an exact symmetry anyway. So we expect both components to be there. But I actually don't know too much more about Yannai waves, and so. That's something that maybe some of the people in our program would know more about.
Questions?
Yes, please. If you have interesting underwater topologies,
mm-hmm.
do you get interesting waves on top of those?
Valleys
and valleys?
Yeah. So in that numerical experiment I showed you with the scattering, that was effectively topography. So imagine a seamount or something where the water got shallower. So to the extent that the waves extend deep enough to interact with the topography, then yeah, you could get some interesting effects.
Yeah.
So the X-state of topological insertion always exists. Then the Kelvin wave, actually, why it only happens during the El Nino years, but does not happen during the non-El Nino years?
Well, so there has to be a source of energy, some sort of excitation for these waves. And it's the coupling of the atmosphere to the ocean that does this. So
something during that El Nino years are exciting these waves.
Right. And we're very bad at predicting them. So there's something called the spring predictability barrier, or basically not able to predict very far in the future whether an El Nino will occur or not. They occur every few years, but in seemingly random patterns.
Brad, I'd like to ask a maybe final question. Have you thought of the possibility of non-abelian months?
I haven't, but I know others have. This was the simplest kind of model with 3 degrees of freedom, but one could imagine systems with more degrees of freedom and then maybe effective spin degrees of freedom, some non-abelian nature. Yeah.
Yes, please.
Is there, how much of this story change regarding the geophysical application if you worried about the tangential component of the Earth's angular acceleration? So the equator, of course, F, we find goes to zero.
Right.
Not the vector.
Yes, right. So there's some vertical, some horizontal component of
radial direction.
Yeah. Right. I think the important thing is the time reversal symmetry is reversed in the two hemispheres. So I wouldn't expect that details like that would affect things qualitatively. That's just kind of the beauty of the topological argument. But it may affect it in detail. Yes, that's true. So also the I dropped the centrifugal term, which affects the local G. Yeah.
Are there any waves around black holes?
That's above my pay grade there.
You talked about making connections with soliton theory.
Yeah.
So you could look at maybe the Ostrowski equations, which are rotating generalizations of KDE.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yes, yeah. So, yeah, I'd like to learn about that. Maybe we can discuss
please,
that.
Please. Your experiment made me think about the Taylor Fullman experiment we do in the lab. Is that there or
not? Oh, yeah. So I don't know, but that reminds me to say that I think that these topological waves could exist in many different contexts, and perhaps even for our boundary layer system, where we have different types of waves. We should think about that. So we have systems where there are spontaneous flows or flows that are induced by winds, and I wouldn't be surprised if some of the systems we'll be discussing over the next couple months might have waves that have an origin that can be explained by these types of topological arguments. But I'd be happy to discuss in detail.
Well, any more questions? If not, let's thank Brad for a beautiful talk.
Thank you.